Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. You can ask your financial advisor about Putnam 529 for America or visit putnam.com/529. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We had too big to fail. What about just too big? Bank of America really wants to get smaller. European banks just want to survive, and what those words we use around the office really mean. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 1-800-555-8733. And by the Batten Institute at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, presenting the Jefferson Innovation Summit, a conversation about creating and sustaining an entrepreneurial future.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday. This one's the 12th of September. Good to have you with us. This morning, President Obama had one of those Rose Garden events presidents have when they want a nice backdrop for a big announcement. It wasn't all that big announcement this time, actually. The president just wanted to let people know he's sending his jobs bill up to Congress and that he really, really wants it to pass. Unfortunately for him, the Bank of America wasn't listening. Today, B of A CEO Brian Moynihan said he's going to cut 30,000 jobs over the next couple of years. He's trying to dig the country's biggest bank out of the hole it dug for itself by getting too big too fast. It's quite the strategic U-turn, as our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore explains.
Bank of America is the biggest bank in the country. One out of every $10 sitting in a U.S. bank account is there. And it's bought everything from mortgage lenders to credit card companies. For years, it called itself a one-stop shop, a universal bank. So you wouldn't have expected its CEO, Brian Moynihan, to say this to a group of investors today.
We don't have to be the biggest company out there. We have to be the best.
Wait. Bank of America doesn't want to be the biggest bank?
Finally, he seems to be thinking along appropriate lines. It is a good thing that they get simpler and more manageable.
That's Anand Admati, a professor at the Stanford School of Business. But it's not just Bank of America. All the big banks are going to become less profitable because their main lines of business are under pressure, as long as the economy sputters. Charles Elson runs the University of Delaware Center for Corporate Governance and owns stock in Bank of America.
At some point, you can't grow anymore. You have saturated the market. You get too big to manage.
Moynihan says he'll cut billions in expenses and try to corral Bank of America's troubled mortgage business. Elson says he'll believe it when he sees it.
And if the idea is by getting slightly smaller, you become more profitable, I'm all for it. The question is, can he execute it?
Moynihan's task today was to get investors enthused about the new Bank of America. But it seems the bank still has a lot to prove. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
There's no word as of yet exactly how many of those 30,000 jobs will be lost in B of A's hometown of Charlotte, North Carolina. Even after the financial crisis, Charlotte still calls itself the second largest financial center in the country, after New York. So we sent Amy Scott down there this morning to see how it's taking the B of A news.
As Bank of America CEO Brian Moynihan spoke in New York today, the anxiety in uptown Charlotte was palpable.
Everything that happens in the bank in front of me impacts my business immediately.
Just outside Bank of America's offices, Vic Warani, also known as the Chili Man, sells hot dogs. He says his business is down 40 to 50% in the last few years.
Anytime there's layoffs, you know, you got fear, you've got people walking out the door, and anytime there's fear, there's less chance people are going to come out and buy a hot dog or lunch anywhere. They're saving their money making turkey sandwiches or peanut butter and jelly.
And Warani isn't the only one at his house who's worried. His wife works at Bank of America, doing something to do with risk. He's not sure exactly.
Everybody's on edge. Everybody's, you know, wondering if they're going to be part of the, 30,000? Yeah, that's harsh, man.
People have been on edge in Charlotte for years. Finance is one of the city's biggest industries. Hundreds of bank employees have been laid off since the financial crisis. I first met hairdresser Yvonne Curtis almost 3 years ago when the other local bank, Wachovia, was on the brink. It was later bought by Wells Fargo. Back then, Curtis was worried about her clients at Wachovia. She has several at B of A as well.
It's sort of fashionable to vilify bankers, but these are some of the finest people I've ever worked with, so I don't want them to lose their jobs.
But Curtis says things worked out better for Wachovia's employees than many people expected. Wells Fargo reassigned a lot of people. One of the survivors is Titus Sandy, who works in derivatives at Wells Fargo.
You find that people move from one bank to the other. So when people are being laid off, it's a friend or a family member. So I think they're in it together by the end of the day.
He and his colleagues are watching Bank of America closely. They're keeping their eyes on Wells Fargo, too. It's also reportedly planning more layoffs. In Charlotte, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
For a day that had train wreck written all over it, things actually turned out pretty well on Wall Street on this Monday. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Today's update on the European debt crisis goes a little something like this. Greece is in trouble and the Germans don't really want to pay for another bailout. That's an oversimplification, to be sure, but not much of one. The slightly longer version goes like this. People are slowly coming to grips with the fact that Athens might actually default sooner rather than later, and that big banks in France and Germany and right here are dangerously exposed to it. Here with us from the European desk in London to explain is Marketplace's Stephen Beard. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
We've spoken before about, you know, how this euro crisis might end, and usually it's been in the forms of bailouts. One gets the sense, though, especially after this past weekend, that it's a less pleasant ending that people are thinking about, and it's much closer than anybody hopes.
Well, yes, the end is certainly nigh, the end of the crisis, that is. But it could go one of two ways. The euro certainly could blow up and disintegrate. But it also could be rescued and stabilized and turned back into the reasonably firm currency that it was.
Let's take the bad option first. What does it look like if the eurozone blows up, if Greece defaults and everything goes to heck?
Very ugly indeed. The advent of the euro has led to a big increase in the amount of cross-border borrowing between the countries that use the euro. So banks, for example, are full of debt denominated in euros but are rising in other countries. So if the euro collapsed, it would be very messy. Banks could collapse too. There's likely to be a huge credit crunch as European banks stop lending to each other. And that would quickly be transmitted to the other side of the pond, of course, because of the exposure of American banks to Europe.
Let's take the happier option then and tell me what it looks like if there's a pleasant ending to this thing. Does it basically involve Germany paying a whole lot of money?
Yes, it does. I mean, the euro could be saved, but it needs solidarity. I mean, if the eurozone united and said, OK, we're all in this together, we're all using one currency, we've got to support each other, the euro would survive. And that, as you say, effectively means Germany being prepared to bail out other countries in trouble. The German people are not wildly enthusiastic about this. They see themselves as disciplined. They tend to pay their taxes. They don't see why they should shovel large amounts of their hard-earned cash down to Greece, where tax dodging is a national pastime and corruption is rife.
Let me see, though, if I can put it in more black and white terms. Which one is more expensive? Is it more expensive to let the euro collapse, or is it more expensive to bail out five or six small to medium-sized European economies?
It's much more expensive to let the euro collapse. Right. There was a study by UBS, the Swiss bank, recently indicating that if Germany had to pick up the pieces following the collapse of the euro, it would cost six times as much, at least six times as much, as it would cost to bail out the weaker members. So it does seem it's going to be much cheaper for Germany to carry on bailing out the good but leaky ship euro rather than see it sink.
Very quickly, Stephen, on the way out, my premise that we started with, that the end is closer somehow than it has seemed in the past. Do you agree?
Yes, very much so, because you have leading German politicians and officials talking quite openly about Greece defaulting and Greece leaving the eurozone. And that's a very strong signal to the markets. This crisis is reaching some sort of crescendo soon.
Stephen Beard in London for us. Thank you, Stephen.
Okay, Kai.
You've heard, perhaps, of the theory of peak oil, the idea that there's only so much crude out there to be had, and when we start to run out, that's it. That's all we got. There is another critical resource whose coming peak has gotten much less attention, but unlike oil, it has no alternative. We truly can't live without phosphorus, and the vast majority of it is locked up in just one country. So, how do we fight the coming phosphorus shortage? The answer, says Marketplace's Jeff Horowitz, lies not in our stars, but quite literally in ourselves.
Unless you're a farmer or a serious gardener, you probably just remember phosphorus from high school as an element on the periodic table. So first, a quick science lesson.
The joke goes that phosphate is what holds your genes up.
Ecologist Jim Elser at the University of Arizona says phosphorus binds our DNA together. No phosphorus, no new DNA. Nothing can grow.
There's no substitute for phosphorus in agriculture or in biology. You know, we can't just swap something else in there. That's not going to work.
That's why it's a critical ingredient in fertilizer. If you buy 10-10-10, say, for your garden, that middle number, that's phosphorus. Here's the problem. The world uses so much fertilizer and so much phosphorus, and there's only so much in the ground. Which brings us to a geography lesson.
Morocco is the kingpin of phosphate right now. 85% of the global phosphate reserves are now identified in Morocco.
And the government, the kingdom, controls all of it. So what usually happens when you have insatiable demand and closely held supply? Well, phosphate prices are up 150% since 2007, 60% in just the last year. Fertilizer is already too expensive for many farmers in Africa. American farmers and consumers feel that same pinch. But using less phosphorus, that's a limited option, says ecologist Larry Baker at the University of Minnesota. The growing world's got to eat.
So we're going to have a population of 10 billion people and extremely limited phosphorus reserves if we continue to use them the way we do now. And perhaps a lot of starvation and hardship could follow.
So other than digging in Morocco, where do we get more phosphorus? Here's a hint. The symbol for phosphorus on the periodic table is P.
And there it is, the valuable byproduct.
All over the place.
All over the place.
Larry Jacobson's a manure engineer. Yes, that's a thing. Also at the University of Minnesota. And yes, there are cows and, on this day, lots of sheep right on campus doing their thing. Phosphorus grows plant, animal eats plant, animal shoots much of the phosphorus right back out again, if you can catch it before it washes away. Jacobson says U.S. farmers facing fertilizer prices are getting much more efficient at this kind of thing.
Animal manures have been used crop nutrients for centuries, you know, or eons. This is old stuff. We just kind of had to kind of relearn it and reassess how valuable it is.
Of course, cows and sheep aren't the only chewing, grunting phosphorus factories walking around out there. That's right. I'm looking at you.
Coming into the plant is something on the order of 5 tons a day of phosphorus.
Mike Marinus directs one of the largest sewage plants in the country, the Metropolitan Wastewater Treatment Facility. When you flush in the Twin Cities metro area, it probably goes here. It is state-of-the-art when it comes to taking the phosphorus out of the water. Environmental regulations demand it. But then, like many U.S. plants, it burns it for power. The incineration leaves behind a phosphorus-rich ash that gets hauled to the landfill.
It's there to be recovered. I could envision in the future where maybe the economics change on the value of phosphorus, where there's more of a focus on our ash and the phosphorus in our ash.
Many older, less state-of-the-art sewage plants do truck their treated solid waste to area farm fields. That, paradoxically, is the way of the future, says the University of Minnesota's Larry Baker.
Recycling in the face of resource scarcity is not a new idea. It's just we now will probably have to do this with phosphorus.
In a new paper, Baker calculates how much phosphorus could be conserved or reclaimed in his home region, the Twin Cities.
Phosphorus that you recycle could feed about 2/3 of the people in the area using current agricultural techniques, and you could get more efficient. I wasn't even trying very hard.
Baker did assume some things that might feel far-fetched, returning to a 1978 diet, for example, and dialing back the size of our dogs. Pet food is a major phosphorus user. But that seems to be the thing with phosphorus. To deal with the future, we might have to go back in time. In St. Paul, Minnesota, I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace. We'll be right back.
Coming up, the words of work and their forgotten histories.
Even the word boss actually comes from Dutch plantations.
But first, let's do the numbers. It was a wild day on Wall Street, but in the end, investors shook off worries about Greece defaulting on its debt. The Dow Industrials added 68 points, 0.6%, closed at 11,061. Most of that, by the way, in the final hour or so. The NASDAQ rose 27 points, 1.1%, finished at 2495. The S&P 500 tacked on 8 points, about 0.7%, ended at 1162. Shares in Bank of America picked up 1% following that layoff announcement we told you about. Other banks ended in the black as well. J.P. Morgan Chase also saw a gain of more than 1%. Citigroup lifted 0.8% today. Oil prices ended the day higher, and so did energy stocks. ExxonMobil pumped up more than 1%. Chevron swelled 0.75%. Investors gave a positive rating to McGraw-Hill's plan to split into two companies, one to handle textbook publishing and the other one to oversee its Standard & Poor's credit rating agency. Shares advanced nearly 4% today. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.95%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, offering IRA savings products and a Raise Your Rate 4-year CD. Learn more at allybank.com. By Reputation.com, protecting online privacy by removing your personal data from the Internet and stopping unwanted email. Reputation.com. And by Chevrolet, maker of the new Volt, which plugs in anywhere and goes everywhere. Available in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Treasury Department releases the federal budget for August. In Columbus, Ohio, President Obama talks about proposals to grow the economy and create jobs. And more news on jobs. The House Veterans Affairs Committee holds a summit on employing veterans in the private sector. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. That's American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. An economic boycott against Arizona that's been going on for almost a year and a half is basically over. The protests were in response to the state's tough anti-immigration legislation. But this weekend, several of the main groups involved declared victory, while at the same time admitting their campaign had hurt some of the workers it was meant to help. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has more.
Latino business leaders joined the mayor of Phoenix in pushing to end the boycott. James Garcia represents a statewide coalition that includes business owners, Latino community groups, and the Arizona Hispanic Chamber of Commerce.
The ending of the boycott is significant because it does help the economy when it needs help the most.
The National Council of La Raza was the main group behind the boycott. Spokeswoman Clarissa Martinez says from the beginning, the organization was concerned about the impact on ordinary workers.
We consulted with groups on the ground because we know that boycotts are a blunt instrument.
Hispanic workers were willing to endure some economic pain for the sake of the cause. But just how successful was the boycott? Five states have enacted tough immigration laws similar to Arizona's. But Martinez says it could have been much worse.
The anticipation in several quarters was that this was going to spread like wildfire. And in reality, what we have seen is over 26 states in the last two legislative sessions rejecting this kind of approach.
The Center for American Progress estimates the boycott cost Arizona around $500 million. That covers canceled conventions, lost tax revenues, and lower economic output. So far, Arizona's immigration bill has been stuck in the courts. Hispanic advocates say that if the bill moves forward again, they will bring the boycott back.
I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
This next item is not going to be much solace to healthcare professionals looking for work, but IBM's Jeopardy-winning Watson supercomputer has landed a new gig. WellPoint, the health insurance company, says it's going to use Watson to suggest treatment options and diagnoses to doctors. Marketplace's Steve Henn has more.
After Watson cleaned up on Jeopardy, my editor said she'd kind of like to date him.
Watson, who is Mary Leakey?
You're right.
Let's finish Chicks Dig Me.
After all, Watson listens. Watson's great at understanding human speech with all its ambiguities. Watson absorbs huge amounts of information and learns from experience. My editor wasn't the only one who fell in love.
In general, we envision Watson being used for very complex clinical situations early on.
Sam Nussbaum is chief medical officer for WellPoint Insurance.
Dr. Watson, think of him as a consulting physician. Think of him as having completed med school, internship, residency. And what's unique about Dr. Watson is that he's had fellowships in all medical domains and all medical specialties.
And Watson can apply all that knowledge to patients' charts and electronic records. Kevin Frick's a healthcare economist at Johns Hopkins. He says the hope is Watson will help doctors keep up with new science, avoid mistakes, and reduce healthcare costs.
If you make it feel like something that people can easily use and want to use and can make use of, that's great. But
bedside manner still matters.
Yes.
And that's where Watson may have an advantage over programs that have been tried before, because it's great at understanding spoken language. Still, Manoj Saxeni at IBM says it's a mistake to think of Watson as a real doctor. It's a tool.
To use your dating example, we don't want to date Watson, but we just want to help Watson find us the right partner.
Saxeni says Watson will never replace your physician, and it'll never bring you flowers. But it could make your doctors better at their jobs. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
This next 3.5 minutes of the broadcast are for all you clockless workers grinding away in the countless cube farms out there. If you need a translation, I direct you to a new book called The Wage Slave's Glossary. It's a new collection of terms about work and the workplace. Joshua Glenn is one of the co-authors. Josh, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Why write this book? I mean, we got dictionaries all over the place.
Our previous book was The Idler's Glossary, and that was a collection of terms that were celebrating a certain style of life, the idler's way of life, where you don't let work define you, who you are and what you do. And this one is looking at the other side of that coin, which is the fact that so many of us work at jobs where we don't have very much control over how we do it or when we do it or what we're doing even.
Run me through some of the definitions, some of your favorite key phrases in this dictionary, would you?
I'm very interested in all these words that come from the workplace that people use to describe themselves. For example, the word downtime. It was a mid-century term that meant time when a machine is out of action or unavailable for use. And today,
that's
of
great.
Course, it means that human beings who aren't working are compared to machines that are being serviced or robots who are being recharged. And the worst thing of all is that many of us now use downtime to describe our own weekends and vacations.
Yeah,
we look at a lot of corporate jargon, of course, things like the clockless worker, loyalty time, flexibilization, these kind of sinister euphemisms for bad things that corporations like to do.
Yeah.
Clockless worker being somebody who's willing to ignore what the clock says and just keep working. And loyalty time being another word for unpaid overtime. Even the word boss actually comes from Dutch plantations. A work boss was somebody who was in charge of the overseer of the slaves on the plantation. So the fact that we've now come to use that in a completely, you know, almost an admiring way, it's no longer a pejorative, says a lot about how much we've forgotten about how work has developed over the years.
It's funny that we have so many words relating to and about and of this place where we spend, you know, a third of our lives, really. I mean, it's kind of interesting that we don't explore that more.
Yeah, and you know, there's a lot of ideas about the nature of work, you know, hidden in all of that. For example, there used to be a term in the 18th century called the after-dinner man, which was somebody who went back to work after they had eaten their dinner. And, of course, at the time, that was considered a very strange thing to do. Dinner time is when you're supposed to be done with work. Why would you go back? Either you're unhealthily addicted to work or you have too much of it. And, of course, today we're all after-dinner men, and we think nothing of flipping open the laptop after dinner and finishing up a PowerPoint or sending off some work emails. But, you know, once upon a time, that was a pathetic individual who was the after-dinner man.
Yeah, although it occurs to me that, you know, you and I are having an interesting discussion about all these words that people use for work. There are 14 million people who don't have jobs who would love to be required to flip on the laptop after dinner or something, you know?
Well, I don't know if they would love that, but they'd love to have a job. Once upon a time, there was a quite stark distinction between an artisan and a hireling or a servant. And the artisan was somebody who could direct their own work, who could come and go as they pleased, who wasn't told how to do what they did. And a hireling or a servant was somebody who couldn't do any of those things. Today, of course, most of us are in the latter category. Most of us who have managers or bosses are pretty much told what to do and how to do it. The book is not against working per se. It doesn't say that, you know, somehow magically we'd all have to do nothing. But it does suggest that perhaps there's other ways that things could be organized besides, you know, one guy is your manager and the other person is the worker.
Yeah. My favorite is GTFBTW, which we can't actually say on the radio, but you can look it up on our website. Josh Glenn is the co-author of the book called The Wage Slave's Glossary. Josh, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Marketplace is supported by FreshBooks, an online invoicing service for freelancers and small businesses designed to help save time, look professional, and make invoicing easy. More at FreshBooks.com. By CenturyLink, a new kind of broadband company linking Americans coast to coast with consistently fast speeds and personal service. More at CenturyLink.com. And by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time, on the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out, check out the sky tonight if you get a chance. On the Chinese calendar, this is the Mid-Autumn Festival, when the moon is at its fullest and brightest. Mooncakes are logically the traditional gift and symbol of the holiday. Not too long ago, our man in Shanghai, Rob Schmitz, did a story on the Chinese mooncake black market, which prompted a musical group called Songwriters in Seattle to come up with this little ditty. Marketplace and the Arts. If it caught your fancy, we've got the whole thing on our website. It's marketplace.org. I thought it was kind of catchy. Anyway, that is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow added 68 points, about 2/3%. The NASDAQ up 27 points, just over 1%. The S&P 500 tacked on 8 points, more than 2/3%. Our producers include Avishai Artsy, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time, back here, saving gas by driving smarter.
When you have to fill up, you know, one less time a month, you know, you start to think, well, this might be worth it.
Hypermiling, or the story in which I get yelled at for driving too fast. I'm Kai Rizdal. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, that's American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.